Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. Dr. Larry Burris is a journalism professor here at MTSU, also a First Amendment expert, and if you are a frequent listener of this station, you have more than likely heard his commentaries. We're going to give him a chance to do 30 minutes worth of commentary today, because we're just going to sit here and have a discussion about what's going on in the news media in general, and the way things are going in various aspects of journalistic coverage. So, Larry, thanks for being here.
It's good to be here. Good to be here.
Let's start off with the swine flu outbreak. I had always been told that you use the word epidemic and conversely you use the word breakthrough or medical breakthrough very rarely and with, you know, a great deal of caution because you don't want to make it meaningless by overusing it or using it when it's not applicable. The news media has taken a few hits for, in the perception of some, overreacting to the swine flu outbreak in this country because of all the deaths that occurred in Mexico. How do you think the coverage has shaken out?
I think that the coverage has probably been overblown, overwrought, way too hot for what really happened. The problem is, in a story like this, how do you know how much is too much? If the epidemic, pandemic had taken off, then the public would have wanted to know that when it first started. So we had, unfortunately, several hundred people have died. That is sad. That is a tragedy. But in terms of overall effect, 30,000 people a year die from the flu, ordinarily.
The regular flu.
The regular flu, right. And flu has a tendency to mutate. So it's really hard to tell how to cover this. The CDC issued all sorts of warnings. The World Health Organization issued all sorts of warnings. So when those experts say, we're having a problem, the news media just assume there is a problem. And they're going to put out all the news that's available on that problem. Turns out the problem was not as great as everybody thought it was. We saw the same thing happen a couple of years ago with the bird flu and a couple of other incidents like that, where it just didn't turn out to be as bad as everybody thought it was going to be. But then you go back 50 years to 1959 and the millions of people who died in the Hong Kong flu. You go back to 1917, the millions of people who died in that flu epidemic. It's really difficult to know how to cover that kind of story.
Was the media's reaction to the outbreak government-driven in that you've got the Department of Health and Human Resources and the Department of Homeland Security, both cabinet level, and the CDC all jumping on this and getting into the media as frequently as they could, possibly because the Obama administration did not want to be seen as or criticized for being quote-unquote derelict because of President Bush's too little too late reaction to Hurricane Katrina.
That was part of it. You really don't know how quickly to jump into this. So the news media, in covering the federal agencies or the world agencies, the World Health Organization, they were getting all sorts of news. They were getting press releases and advisories, and you can't ignore those. When the officials say, hear what's going on, at the same time, though, rarely did I hear the fact that 30,000 people a year die from the regular strain of flu anyway. Didn't hear a whole lot about that. There was no real context. Nobody really saying, okay, there's the possibility of a bad thing happening, certainly, but how bad is it right now? And it wasn't that bad. Yes, people died. Not trying to minimize that. But in terms of overall impact, there just wasn't very much. That's like any other big news event. The question is, at what point do you start to cover it? You know, for example, back when Ronald Reagan was president, when there was an assassination attempt, everybody heard that the press secretary, James Brady, had died. And reporters checked and checked and checked. They checked for the hospital. They checked the White House press office. They checked his home. Everybody was saying Jim Brady died. So several networks went on the air and said, Jim Brady's dead. Well, he wasn't. He's still very much alive. So at what point do you say, okay, we're going with this story and you hope it's right? You're never 100% certain the story's right. And at some point, you've got to go with the story. And in this case, the story ended up not being a story at all.
And in the interest of context, I heard a lot about the World Health Organization, which is an arm of the UN, raising its alert level to the second highest level worldwide. However, not much was said, it seems to me, about the fact that the World Health Organization has to get the word out, especially to the developing nations where their healthcare system and their communication systems aren't as advanced as those in the developing nations. And maybe that's why the WHO took what seemed to have been an extraordinary step in making it their second highest alert level. It didn't necessarily mean that people in the developed nations should necessarily panic.
But you don't know that therein lies the problem. In the undeveloped countries, second, third world countries, Mexico being a prime example, the disease, the flu epidemic had a tremendous impact. If you look at 100 people killed, 150 people killed, that in one level is a lot of people. On the other hand, and I don't want to minimize that, on the other hand, in the overall global context, there's that many people killed a day in automobile accidents.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you just don't know how to cover it. So when you get an agency like the WHO going to their second highest level, that's a news story. Mm-hmm. That has to be covered. Without getting into the psychology of it, I think the entire society over the years has gotten somewhat fearful about everything.
Yeah.
And we're afraid to take a walk at night. We're afraid to play outside in the rain, for example. We're going to catch a cold. We're going to get sick. I think the entire society, for a number of reasons, has kind of regressed. I remember, you know, when you and I were children, we used to run around barefoot and we drink out of the hose.
Sure.
Well, you would never see that today. Everybody's very fearful, and I kind of wonder if that played into that. There's this global fear of everything out there, and that was probably part of it.
Would government officials have a case if they had said, look, if we had not reacted governmentally, bureaucratically, to the swine flu outbreak as strongly as we did, the news media would have kicked our butts from hell to breakfast over letting the possibility of another Hurricane Katrina happen without the appropriate government intervention?
Absolutely. Now, in the case of Hurricane Katrina, we saw the devastation. That was real clear, and the government just didn't respond. Here was a case where you put out a warning, the various government agencies put out a warning, the media had to respond. If they hadn't responded and the epidemic never developed, that would have been okay. But if they hadn't responded and the epidemic did develop, it would have been too late. I mean, the disease is now spreading rapidly and nobody knew about it until it actually happened. So you're really kind of caught there. What do you do? What don't you do? And we see the same sort of thing in bomb threats being called into schools. We see the same thing here at the university. How do you respond to a bomb threat in a building? Do you ignore it? Since most bomb threats are hoaxes anyway, do you just ignore them? That's fine to ignore it until a building blows up.
Right.
And then everybody's in trouble. We should have responded. Yeah, we see the same sort of thing in the airline industry. Airplanes can be made almost perfectly safe. Are we willing to pay for that? Probably not. There's that cost-benefit ratio. And if I'm the one injured in the accident, you bet I want them real safe. But what about the other millions of people who aren't injured? So there's that cost-benefit. And how do you know cost-benefit like that works great when nothing happens?
Let's veer from this, since this seems to be a good segue opportunity here, into weather coverage in general. Some of the young people who transferred up here from Dillard, from Xavier, from New Orleans area schools after Hurricane Katrina, because their schools were devastated, told me that they had evacuated, taken great pains to evacuate for prior hurricanes, and they turned out to be, you know, a lot of rain and a great big nothing in terms of damage. So they had become jaded, did not evacuate for Hurricane Katrina, decided they just hunker down, get drunk, and have a party, and found themselves in a situation where they were scrambling to hotwire cars and get the heck out of Dodge when they realized that this was going to be the mother of all storms. One of my pet peeves is that local meteorologists, and I'm not just talking about the Nashville television market, I'm talking about local meteorologists in all TV markets across the country, tend to make the least little raindrop sound as though it's the end of the world in order to spark ratings during ratings periods. I don't know, or they're being told they have to do this by consultants. I don't know why, but it makes people like me tend to become really jaded when something like the Good Friday tornadoes that devastated part of Murfreesboro occur. Why can't there be a more balanced approach to television coverage of local weather?
It's the same thing we had talked about with Katrina, the flu. News should be exciting. And a boring weather report, well, there's nothing going on today, or it's going to rain a little bit, that's not very exciting. And people turn those out, that they just don't listen to them. The audience wants some excitement out there. And we put out all the stories, we put out all the warnings. But once again, when nothing happens, we tend to get very, very jaded. But it's that one time when something does happen. I remember during the Good Friday hurricane, there were people in my building were kind of walking around outside. We're under this tornado watch or tornado warning, and people are walking around outside. And that was great, unless a tornado had come that direction. So you really don't know what's going to be happening. So the media are doing a service. They're saying, here is a potential danger. And if the danger doesn't hit you, well, that's really great. But it did hit somewhere else. And the broadcast is going out everywhere. So some people would have heard the broadcast and sought shelter. The vast majority did not, because generally speaking, disasters don't affect a vast majority. They affect a small group, and that's okay. It's okay to look at the victims in Katrina and say, well, that was really terrible down there. That never happens here. Well, we're not going to have a hurricane here, certainly, a bad storm. But if it does happen here, you're going to want to know about it. So we could have – we listened to winter weather reports, and I remember a few years ago heard one from Nashville, and it talked about how terrible conditions were up in Nashville. The roads were closed, and schools were closed, and stay off the roads. I looked out my window, and it was about 35 degrees and sunny down here. So you just, the broadcasts from the Nashville station are going out everywhere, and so they were affecting that audience up there. So if we had the radio station here, WMOT, and they put out a weather warning for Murfreesboro, that may be, in fact, affecting you and I in Murfreesboro. The folks who get the signal, who get the program up in Nashville, they're going to say, what in the world is that all about? Well, the broadcast is going out everywhere. So they have to serve that small group that's going to be affected. And again, most disasters are not that big in the grand scheme of things. But you've got to get the word out to protect those people who are going to be affected.
Do you know if there's any research been done, or just you noticing anecdotally, whether the intensity of the meteorologist's assertiveness in doing the report, shall we say, goes up any with during sweeps weeks, or if they focus more on severe weather during sweeps weeks?
That they don't so much focus on severe weather, that the overall programming pattern changes during sweeps week. But here's the big flaw in the ratings argument. If you're listening to WMOT, for example, and you're listening to the weather, you're not going to hear the weather on the other stations. You're listening to this one, so you're not going to know what they're doing, so it's not going to have any impact if the station meteorologist here really hypes the weather. Other people who aren't listening to this station aren't going to hear that. They're not going to know it's being hyped. So individual events are not going to change the ratings. If there's a major disaster, if there's a big airplane crash, for example, up at Metro in Nashville, and you're watching one of the TV stations, you're not going to know if the other station had that story on 5 seconds earlier, 30 seconds earlier, a minute earlier, because you're watching this station.
You're going to be glued to that station, for it, provided it's doing continuing around-the-clock coverage and preempting its other programming.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it's not going to matter if the other station's on 30 seconds earlier, because you're not going to know that you're watching this station. So this idea that we're going to hype the news to increase the ratings doesn't work, because you're already watching your particular station, listing your particular station. What the sweeps do is the overall programming. For the next week, we're going to run this program, this program, this program. And if I'm the broadcast station, I may run some ads in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. I may do some other sorts of advertising to try to attract you to my station.
The television stations make promos with snippets of their severe weather coverage
exactly.
In it saying, see, we were right on top of it.
Exactly.
That's why you should tune to our station
exactly.
for weather coverage.
Yes, but again, if they're 30 seconds earlier, it's not going to matter anyway. And most stations for really big events are all on top of it. because they're all watching each other.
Right.
You know, every newsroom out there in Nashville, if you pick newsroom A, they've also got B, C, D, and E up there anyway. And if one of the other stations breaks in, the news director, news producer is going to say to his or her staff, hey, look at this story. We need to get on this too. And it's going to be a matter of seconds before all the stations are covering the big event.
Let's go to the print media now and the future or lack thereof of newspapers. Time magazine, I believe it was, devoted an entire issue to this subject. Some newspapers are dying. Some are dying by degrees. Some have already died. The afternoon newspaper became a thing of the past years ago, for all intents and purposes, because of television and the internet. Is there a business model that will help newspapers survive in print form, or will they all have to go online? And if they do all go online, is there a business model that they can use to collect money that way? I know the Wall Street Journal charges for content online already.
If I hear one more time the death of news and newspapers, I'm going to shoot somebody.
Please don't shoot me.
Please don't. The media delivery systems are always changing. Newspapers, I don't want to say newspaper business is dying. There are going to be fewer and fewer newspapers. There just are, because that business model is not working, and it's the fault of the newspapers. They all went online. They all began giving the content away, which is a real foolish business model. You don't give your product away. They were doing it to attract advertisers. Well, that's fine. So the advertisers then left the newspaper, the print edition, and went to the website. So the print edition doesn't have any income. At the same time, there will always be a group of people who want the newspaper, who want that in their hand for whatever reason, so that the major newspapers will be there for many more years. The smaller papers are going to die. The news operation will still be there. They may have web news. They may have other versions out there.
But you still have to have people out on the street covering
Absolutely. The
city council, covering the fires, covering the wrecks,
covering
the whatever. It's still a labor-intensive business
yes,
if you
it
do it right.
If you do it right, and that's the real key, do it right. There are too many news organizations that are using, I guess they call them iReporters.
Quick and dirty techniques.
Quick and dirty techniques with untrained, I won't call them journalists, with untrained people who are providing, and I don't want to say news, who are providing whatever that stuff is out there.
Content.
And those news organizations suffer because of that. News has to be covered by people who know what they're doing, and that is not getting too hot here,
yeah.
is not being done by some joker with a cell phone camera. Even if it's just a simple fire, you've got to know who to contact, who the fire marshal is, how do you cover one of these sorts of stories, and just showing the picture out there is not the news.
Yeah, everybody has access to all kinds of technology on their personal computers these days. How do you know if you're a news gathering agency getting this image from a citizen on a cell phone that it hasn't been manipulated
Absolutely. In
some way? How do you know it's an image that depicts reality instead of something that's been altered to fit somebody's agenda?
You don't know that, and that's part of the problem, because we've seen on social networking sites where those images have been manipulated. And the way you avoid that is by using trained reporters to cover the news. This problem, this issue with untrained people is nothing new. We have always had private citizens at city council meetings, at trials, but they weren't doing the reporting because there were reporters there. And now, because of budget cuts, because the bean counters have taken over, we in the media have had to rely more and more on those untrained people out there to do those sorts of stories, and it's affected the content. It's affected the public perception of what goes on out there. Those sorts that sort of coverage is fine. If somebody wants to start a blog site, wants to start their own website, and cover the news their way, that's great. But you better not stick the name of a major news organization on it. That's not what those organizations should be doing. They should be using their reporters, and as you said, it's very labor-intensive. But again, it's hard to justify in the financial sector, the accounting department, if you've got a reporter who's doing a really great job giving you really great stories once a week. well, it may be a really dynamite story, but the bean counters, the accountants in the accounting and finance office, they're trying to match up product with income. Mm-hmm. And you're turning out one story a week. That doesn't sound like very much, but it could be a very important story, and that's what's being lost.
Another one of my pet peeves is the amalgamation and consolidation of humongous media corporations after government deregulation. And I just wonder if this, which has been a trend over the last 20 years or so, would you say, or at least, or 30 maybe
about
even?
Right. About 25, 30 years. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I just wonder if that has resulted in a sort of corporate tunnel vision that has left the powers that be unable to see into the future and have resulted in them getting in the mess that they're in now.
That's exactly what's happened. They've taken a very short-sighted, here's this quarter's budget. What have you done for me, you as a reporter or news operation, what have you done for me lately? And you just can't say to those people, well, we've turned out three award-winning stories and it's cost whatever all the salaries and equipment are. That's not a good business model. We in the news business are not creating a product like a car. It's not a unit type of operation. And it's very hard to justify that, which is why the major news organizations have cut back on overseas bureaus. They've cut back on staff, and it's showing a whole lot. It's showing very poorly, in fact.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you're a media consumer and you go online and you're not journalistically trained, but you want to become better informed, how do you separate the wheat from the chaff? How do you separate the credible from the not so credible?
We in the media need to do a better job explaining what it is we do and why we're important. We need to be able to justify ourselves so that people can, in fact, distinguish between the junk news sites and the real news sites. We in the education business need to do a better job teaching our students and the general public how to consume news. How do you, in fact, differentiate between the news and that other content out there? And we're just not doing a very good job of doing that, unfortunately.
What happened to newspaper in the classroom type programs? I remember getting my weekly reader once a week when I was in grammar school. I had the opportunity to take a journalism course when I was a sophomore in high school and work on the high school newspaper. What's happening in K through 12? Your wife is an education professor. She knows whereof she speaks on the K through 12 scene. What's happening to try to help inculcate an attitude of wanting to be a more aware media consumer in kids K through 12 before they even get to college?
What's happened there is called standardized testing, that more and more of the schools are teaching to the test. Everything has got to be based on a standardized test score, no child left behind. So all those other, we might call them enrichment programs, music, art, physical education, journalism, those are all going by the wayside because the feeling is they don't contribute to the mission. Just like the bean counters at the major news organizations, it's all what is cost effective and what's not. And if we have to spend more time teaching to the test and something else has to be laid aside, pushed aside, shoved aside, gotten rid of, that's what's gotten rid of because it doesn't impact the almighty test score. Hmm. And we're losing a lot of the culture. We're losing a lot of those things that really set us apart. Art, history, the history of art sorts of things. How does that contribute? Well, it doesn't contribute to a test score, but it does contribute to your humanity. Physical education, we're seeing this huge epidemic of childhood diabetes, obesity in children because they're not getting outside, because we have to take away from recess, because we have to work on the standardized test scores. And it's the same sort of problem. We don't have time in K-12 to teach that anymore. And so we end up with people who don't know how to consume the news.
I'm not saying that we should make the standardized test score the be-all, end-all, but if you're in the system and you're trying to work it politically as an administrator, can you not make the argument to the people who are enamored of the standardized test, look, if you teach the kids how to read a newspaper and help them develop the critical thinking skills that go along with reading a newspaper intelligently, doesn't that help them do better on the standardized test?
The standardized test doesn't cover those. The standardized test covers the standard curriculum, reading, writing, and arithmetic. So since the standardized test score is right now, it's this year's standardized test score, we don't have time to worry about next year or the year after or 5 years from now. We, the teachers, we've got to worry about this year's test score right now, so we better cut recess out a little bit. Better just cut back on those music classes. Maybe don't need quite as much art because we've got to concentrate on the standardized test score right now. There's very little foresight going on there. Mm-hmm. And that's politically driven. It's parent driven. We want to have the best school. Well, how do you measure that? You measure by standardized test scores.
Yeah. A bloody shame. I can remember my mother keeping me home from school deliberately one cold day in 1973 because she wanted me to watch the inauguration of the president on television. Not that she was a fan of Richard Nixon in any way, but she wanted her daughter to have an appreciation of what the inauguration of a president was like, and she knew I wouldn't be able to watch TV in school. And she didn't think that my education was any worse for it.
Absolutely. We were over in visiting some schools in Australia a couple of years ago. We're talking to some high school students, and we're talking about biased media. And the students were saying, of course media in Australia are biased. Absolutely. And somebody said, well, how do you get the overall news? They said, well, we, high school students, we read 3 and 4 newspapers a day. Oh, okay. They're spending time doing that. We were in a third grade class, and they were learning about television. And many third grade classes will do this sort of thing. They'll do a television program. We did it. You probably did it. One, the teacher said to one of the third grade students, this is a very good program. Who is your intended audience for this, though? You've got a third grader, 8, 9 years old maybe, having to figure out who's the audience for this program. This just isn't throw something together. This is thinking about the content and how it relates to an audience. You would never see that in an American school. We don't have time for that because of the standardized test scores.
Moving into television, as we approach the transition into totally digital TV, I wonder what, as we are bombarded in as television viewers with all these announcements, I wonder what the big fuss is about, because most people are already on cable or satellite anyway by now, and if you have the converter box, then you don't need to worry about replacing that old analog TV just yet. I mean, how many people are still on the antenna in this country anyway?
There are enough to cause a problem. There are enough out there saying this isn't fair, this is not right, and it's there's that sense of entitlement out there. You're absolutely right, there are not that many. It doesn't cost that much, but the feeling is everybody has to have television. Well, no, they don't. Television is a luxury, and if you can't afford the cable box right now, I'm really sorry about that. Work a little harder to get one. It's going to happen. It's better for everybody. But again, we have that small group out there that, for whatever reason, doesn't want to convert, and so we have to cater to them, and we shouldn't be doing that.
Oh, you mean they don't want to watch Real Sports with Bryant Gumbel on HBO and have a choice of being able to watch 15 different NFL games on Sunday at the click of a dial?
Apparently not. And my guess is most people can't tell the difference between HD this and HD that anyway.
Yeah.
Most people aren't watching in the perfect environment. You may notice when you buy your new big screen TV, the setup instructions want you to be so many inches away in this kind of room. Most people aren't listening in ideal conditions, so it's really not going to matter a whole lot.
What's so great about a big screen HD TV anyway? I mean, I think a lot of people buy it just because it's a status symbol. It's indicative of a certain bourgeois level of achievement.
It's a great picture. if I have my little black and white or my little analog color set, it is a vast improvement. No doubt about that. It just looks a whole lot better. We see the same thing with movies. The movies aren't using film anymore. It's all digital. And you can tell a difference between the poor end of the old and the high end of the new. There is a tremendous difference there. And if you have the income to be able to spend, the disposable income, the discretionary income, and that's what you want to do, well, get it. That's fine. Other people want to spend their money traveling or going to the opera or going to a concert. If that's how they want to spend their money, that's fine. And a lot of people are spending their money on big screen TVs. The problem is there's a lot of people who can't afford them are spending their money on big screen TVs. That's another whole economics
right.
issue there that we probably don't have time for today.
That's true.
But yeah, you know, well, it's out there. I want it, so I'm going to spend money I don't have on it. Big mistake all around.
Well, if there's something I want to listen to and I'm really interested in it, I don't care if it comes over a crackling AM radio as long as it's worth my while and stimulates my brain.
Exactly. You know, if that's your thing about that particular item, it's like everything else out there. Some people won't watch high school football because it's not real football. They want to see professional level football. That's fine. Some people will laugh about theater here in Murfreesboro because it's not real theater. Of course it's real theater. Mm-hmm. You know, it may not be the Metropolitan Opera, but I don't care.
Yeah.
So I go to the real theater here in town because that's real enough for me. Other people would say no, so it's a matter of, you know, what can you afford? What do you like to do? People do it with cars and food. You know, some people only buy brand names. Other people will buy off-brand. Mm-hmm. What can you afford? What's out there?
Dr. Elise Helfer did a great job as Blanche Dubois in Streetcar Named Desire in a local production. I just want to say that. She's an English professor here. Dr. Larry Burris is a journalism professor here, and he's also a First Amendment expert. And thanks for being on, Larry. We'll come back sometime and talk about more media stuff.
Enjoyed it, and we'll do it again.
This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Remember, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at www.mtsunews.com. And we're also available on iTunes.